So good evening to everyone who's tuning in this evening for the last and final session of the 12th annual Conference of Jewish Medical Ethics. It's really a great pleasure to conclude our program with something which I think will be extremely insightful and well-timed. We have an expert panel, which I will introduce shortly. And to put this into some context, today we've gone through the circuit from historical aspects, medical halachic aspects, going through some of the emotional, social, and personal issues that deal with COVID, and now we sort of want to look out into the future. With all that's been read and published, Jay mentioned that he saw a very interesting quote from a Rabbi Sid Schwartz, who neither of us necessarily knew, but I think it sets the stage for tonight's discussion. And he wrote as follows: "This moment," referring to where we are now and looking into the future, "provides an unprecedented window to move synagogues, communities, shuls away from practices and modes of operation that are dysfunctional, and to introduce innovations that in normal times would likely have faced opposition. Leaders are given wide latitude to step into crisis moments and take action, often with far less resistance than happens normally." And we've assembled a panel this evening, which we hope will use this as a springboard to move this question and the statement. You know, is this something that is wishful thinking, or is this something that, you know, there is some wonderful opportunities here? I'd like to introduce Rabbi Daniel Karapkin. Rabbi Karapkin is, of course, rabbi at the Beth Avraham Yosef of Toronto in Thornhill. He is also wearing the cap from the as president of the Rabbinical Council of America, the RCA, having also served as regional vice president, and is also the founder of the RCA's Rabbis Forum, an exclusive listserv for Orthodox rabbi. Rabbi Karapkin is also a certified Moylan, just had the pleasure of doing his own grandson during COVID, which I'm sure is a story in and of itself. Rabbi Karapkin has received his Master's of Arts degree in Medieval Jewish and Islamic Thought from UCLA's Department of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures, and a Master of Science from Johns Hopkins University as well. Many of us know Rabbi Karapkin through his shiurim in terms of the author of the new translation of the classic work, the Kuzari. And I must say, above all, he's our Mora d'Asra. So it is really with great pleasure that we have Rabbi Karapkin with us this evening. Rachel Dratch, Associate Director of Educational Innovation at PRISMA, which is the Center for Jewish Day Schools. Rachel has a master's degree in Jewish education from Yeshiva University. She's a fellow, she's a Mandel Jerusalem Fellow and participated in the Mandel Teacher Education Program and has served as a scholar in residence in many communities. Rachel was a student teacher at Michala in Jerusalem before continuing her passion for teaching as a Hebrew school teacher and student leader at Stern College. And finally, on the panel, we also have Yoni Goldstein. Yoni Goldstein is probably best known for being the former editor of the Canadian Jewish News, which unfortunately was one of the victims of COVID as well. He has published extensively in papers, including the National Post, the Globe, Haaretz, and really has a good handle and sense of how the community functions, albeit in Toronto, but understands the interrelationships between the Canadian North American scene as well as that with Israel. So with that, with the panel that we have, the format that we have prepared is we will ask a question to each of them, and we hope that each one of you will look at it through the prism of that you come with your expertise, the rabbi / organization of Jewish organization, education, and community wide. Our first question that we'd like to pose to you is, our community has spent 10 weeks in isolation. What are the risks and opportunities you see coming out of this? I think what we'll start with is Rachel, if you'd like to go first.
Oh, totally. I would love to go first. It's such an honor to be with you. Okay, there are so many opportunities. First of all, thank you for having me. One of the teachers at Prisma, we've been having so many different supports for teachers throughout North America. And one of the teachers that got on 2 weeks ago had shared that she didn't know that her team was capable and willing to do all the things that they've done. So in terms of schools, what teachers expect of themselves is extraordinary. What parents have been able to do at home is extraordinary. And what children have done is extraordinary. So what people are willing and able to do is wonderful. We're learning a lot about what is real learning and what is not. We've also expanded our understanding of what's considered authentic learning. So for example, I have one of, there are a few students I was talking to who said that for the first time ever, they love davening. They love praying. There's something about the distance of the screen that gives them a feeling of vulnerability, but safety, and kids who could never focus before in tefillah are now focusing. It has opposite effects too. We've now learned that some kids are thriving in this environment. There are people now who could never have accessed school, shiurim, anything, and because of Zoom or other things, now they can participate. We've now educated grandparents and great-grandparents on how to use the magic of Zoom so that I cannot imagine another sitter party or graduation that will not be live streamed for them, whereas it used to be that we did not always live stream things. But I think one of the most important things that we're learning is how important social emotional education is, how integral that piece of teaching, you know, when you have a chavrusa, it's not just enough, go into a chavrusa and learn. We're teaching children how to work together, how to be around together. It's because if you could access all this information just by going on YouTube and watching a shiur, or you don't need me. So the value added of day school has to be so articulated, so clear. I mean, I think that I don't want to talk about the dangers so much, but I do think it's important to think about all the important things that we're learning and how the community is coming together in a really magnificent and profoundly moving way.
Rabbi Karofkin, if you have some comments on this question.
Thank you, Rabbi Dr. Laser Friedman, and thank you for that lovely introduction. And Rabbi Kelman, thank you. And to everyone, thanks for being on this amazing program. And God willing, we're starting to see a light at the end of the tunnel. So it's an exciting time. I think for all of us, we're starting to see, amidst the anxiety, we're starting to see some optimism return to all of us. Risks and opportunities, I think I'm really of two minds here. On the one hand, this is not the first pandemic that Klal Yisrael has had to endure. And as such, let's think about who we were before the pandemic started. And it was 100 years since the previous pandemic. And if that's the case, then I don't know how many years it took since the last pandemic for us to find ourselves where we are, where we were just a few weeks ago. But there's a certain part of me that almost sort of like the cynical part of me that says, well, how much are we really going to change? You know, life will get back to normal eventually. It may be a gradual process. But the risk being is that once everyone's healthy again, and especially after a vaccine is developed for the COVID virus, God willing, and I'm sure that something will be brought to the fore to make us all healthy at this point, then we'll probably fit back into the same old patterns, both the positive and the negative. And I am concerned because one of the opportunities that I was looking to institute, and I still hope to be able to do, I just haven't been able to broach it carefully yet because we're only starting to talk about reopening, is what are we going to do to improve the nature of our shul, as far as what happens when we gather together. We are all familiar, and it's been written about a lot, we're all familiar with the phenomenon of social orthodoxy, of what it means for Jews who live an Orthodox lifestyle to gather together in synagogue, not necessarily for a religious experience, but more for a social experience. You know who I feel sorry for the most in the Jewish community? I don't feel sorry for the really frum people. I feel sorry for the socially orthodox. because they're the ones who are missing out the most. Because if they weren't davening in shul, at least they had the social interaction that satisfied whatever needs that they had to be part of an Orthodox community. For the people who are into Orthodox Judaism for the sake of having a relationship with God and their fellow Jew, they were able to at least have a semblance of that even in the privacy of their home. And so my concern is that as we go back to our shuls and we go back to patterns of social orthodoxy, I'm concerned that it'll become business as usual after a while. And so what I have to do as a rabbi, and I think all the rabbis are thinking in this way, is to encourage our balabatim to eliminate the Kiddush club and to eliminate all the talking now before we reopen our doors. And that way the hope is that we'll come back at least with some level of invigoration and repair of whatever breaches existed before the pandemic. I echo what Mrs. Dratch said about the use of technology. And that is the reason why I think that we can be more optimistic about things permanently changing. Every shiur, every class, every instruction is now potentially global. And the reach of every instructor and every student is far greater now that we have a grasp about how to use this technology a little bit better. And then finally, you know, when we talk about risks and opportunities, it's great fodder for rabbis to wax theologically and to talk about what messages, if at all, God has been trying to communicate to us. And so as a theologian, first and foremost, those are the kinds of opportunities we all look for to be able to really have learning experiences that will help us to connect to Hashem even more than before.
Thank you, Rabbi. Yoni, your thoughts?
First of all, thank you all for having me, giving me something to do. I don't have a full-time job. Sunday night is when I'd usually be in the office finishing off the paper. So this is a good way to ease out of that. I think the risks are, you know, twofold. On the one hand, like both panelists have said before, one of the risks is that we end up feeling comfortable enough to just go back to the way things were before. And to not use this as an opportunity. You know, there are other smaller risks like anti-Semitism. You know, I don't think it will surprise anybody that, you know, there are already conspiracy theories being spread online about, you know, Israelis having discovered a vaccine a year ago and hiding it, or Jews being behind something. I don't know if that's anything new. It's just a new subject to bring anti-Semitism into. The opportunity is really obvious. It's, you know, this is a once in a century opportunity, a chance to sort of get everybody together in the community and figure out what our priorities are and how to do that. I think some of that has already begun to happen at the institutional level, but there's certainly more of that can be done. And I think it involves sort of two tracks at once. I think it involves looking at our community structures and seeing what we need in the very short term to care for the most vulnerable in our community. And at the same time, start looking forward to what we want our community to look like when we have an opportunity to all be together in some form again. And I would hope that coming to that vision or coming to some sort of agreement on what that vision looks like will involve the people who have put together the organizational structures until now. It will involve new younger voices who are also being tasked with a great challenge to make the community fit their new reality. And then you also, I think, need to hear from people, from entrepreneurs and people who have successfully done grassroots organizations and startups. I think they could be a great help in figuring out what happens next for the community, because they're used to working with smaller dollars and in smaller groups and with potentially less defined specific roles. And it would seem to me that a community that wants to become more maneuverable would want to highlight those aspects as well. So there's an opportunity for sure, especially for younger generations of Canadian Jews, to have their voice heard. One of the challenges is making sure that those voices do get heard and don't get drowned out in sort of the institutional in the institutional noise. And then I guess that one other risk that I would put out there is, and I'm kind of in it personally, is, you know, parents are under a lot of stress right now. They're trying to do their jobs if they still have them. If they don't, then they're trying to figure out what their next job is going to look like. And in most cases, they're also full-time educators in some way or another. Even if they get a couple of minutes away from a Zoom screen, it's not really conducive to getting a lot of work done. So we'll have to try and figure out ways to help parents figure out whatever the new work-home balance is going to be.
Thank you, Yoni. So we'll move to the second question, which is an outgrowth of the first discussion we had now. And I'm going to address Rabbi Karopkin first. This is more to look at if you had a wish list and if you were able to speak to the idea of realigning priorities and looking at making palpable changes. And just for the record, I know this is being recorded, but you do not have to answer specifically with regards to our shul bayit. But as a general, as a rabbinic, looking at it from the prison perhaps and taking you a little bit away off the shul, and I'll leave you at that. Is this the opportunity to look at the quality of the tefillah, the minyanim in the houses that are done for convenience and not necessarily for the purposes of of helping someone who is a shut-in or those type of things, things of that nature? Is this really something that you envision, something that would be a rabbinic push towards?
There are so many heightened sensitivities as a result of these past 10 weeks plus. A number of them revolve around the shul, as you said, Dr. Friedman, having to do with the nature of how we daven and how we structure our prayer services. I think that for many people who have had more meaningful davening at home than we normally do at shul, I can tell you, and I'm not embarrassed to say, even on a recording, that my davening has been more meaningful more often than not at home than it has been in the shul, for the simple reason that as the rabbi, I'm the one on display, I'm the prop, so to speak. And so there's a greater set level of self-consciousness. But I think that there's a certain self-consciousness among a lot of people. There are a lot of distractions. And one of the things that we've learned how to do is to really talk to God instead of going through the motions and looking like the way we want to look when we're talking to God. But actually now we've been actually doing the talking to God. And I think that the opportunity comes in to be able to deepen that that meaningful behavior. And as you mentioned, Laser, as far as reaching out to people who are shut-ins, we've all now been shut-ins. There's a greater heightened sensitivity to every single member of our community. One of the things that we started, we probably will want to continue, is that we started a core of volunteers. We now have several dozen volunteers who are regularly making calls to our older members. And there are a number of types of communications and outreach to the various members of our community. I've had people who told me that because of either a disability or because they normally don't get out of the house that much for whatever other reason, they have never felt more connected to the shul than during the pandemic. Because before the pandemic, we would send out one or two emails a week if there was for a special announcement. And now we send out a digest every single day of everything that's going on so that people feel that there's a new vitality to a shul that actually is totally empty and locked, but the vitality exists virtually because of the way that we're communicating. And that's certainly something that we've learned and gained sensitivity for. I also want to point out that one of the greatest sensitivities that I think in speaking to a number of people we all have is that when we are able to resume having smachot and having social events, we're not going to be going to the social event as much thinking about what are they serving at the shmorg. Thinking about what they're serving at a social event is like the last thing on my mind right now. And I could really, what we'll be thinking about is how will we be gathering together? And what will the nature of our weddings look like? It used to be that we felt a sense of duty to invite the entire Jewish community to our wedding. Even people who couldn't afford to make large and lavish weddings felt a need to reciprocate to people who had invited them to their chasanas and to their bar mitzvahs and their simchas. And now I think that people are going to start thinking a second time. I don't know what the fallout's going to be to our caterers, and we have an in-house caterer, so I can't say too much more because otherwise I'll get into trouble. But the fact is that I think people are going to start thinking, you know what? The smachot that I've seen on Zoom, where there were 10 people and there was a chuppah, and the joy on the people's faces was not only not less than, but even potentially even greater than what I've seen people have at these hotel and hall weddings because of all of the tension and all of the chazarai that's flying around at the time of a simcha. And here it was just the family in a backyard. There was a greater sense of comfort and in it, living in that moment of living my Yiddishkeit and communing with God and my loved ones. There's a certain beauty that is indescribable that we've been experiencing over the last several weeks that I wish I could bottle and disseminate even once we open up again. But that in itself may change the very texture of how we organize our social events in the future. I think I'll hold it there. There's much more to say.
Thank you, Rabbi. Rachel, again, your comments and your thoughts, and I just, if I can make one comment, the question, of course, assumes that we have a vaccine. So this is looking into that future a little bit beyond the reentry phases. Schools, education, infrastructures, what do you see there? Wish list.
Okay. Going to overlap the last question in this one. The most important thing is that we get our whys really clear. And I think for so long, it was just understood why Jewish schools are important, why sending your kids to a day school is so essential, why coming to shul, all of these whys were just such a given. In order to take the next step as we re-enter and we imagine bigger and better, whatever that means, I don't mean bigger, literally bigger, but something more wonderful, we have to get really clear on our why. What is the value added? And if we're really clear on our why, whatever it is, and we might not all share the same why, everything else sort of follows through. Are you coming to a Jewish school because I want to help you really feel connection to Hashem, to Am Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, Torah, whatever it is. Am I coming to a Jewish school because I want you to marry Jewish? Are you coming to a Jewish school because I want to give you a very good education and propel you into the world? What are your top priorities? And then build from there. Because the next stage is digital citizenship, is preparing kids for the jobs that don't exist yet. And we need to prepare our teachers to teach those skills that our teachers don't yet have for the most part, to teach our kids the skills that they need so that they can get the jobs that haven't been created yet. So that's really crucial. How do we prepare our kids and teach them those next century skills? And now it's like very Daniel Pink, if you've read his stuff, you know, right brain thinking, those social emotional pieces, how do you work with a group? How do you get along? So Rabbi Karavkin, those social pieces of shul are essential, not instead of, but secondary, of course, to the halachic reasons, but those pieces are actually so essential. Those are the pieces that are going to teach our kids how to interact and how to bring their Judaism with them into the boardroom. So I think that imagining bigger and gaining those skills and getting really clear is really essential. Another thing that I think is important to carry with is that the small things matter. Rabbi Karavkin, you mentioned this before so beautifully about the calls to the elderly. Every teacher, every pulpit, every leader in the community who's made a call to someone else in the community, I don't know what else we've ever done in our lives before, but the people who received those calls will remember them forever. Forever. You will remember if your rabbi called you. You'll remember if your kid graduated and missed all the graduation, if there was a bar mitzvah, a bat mitzvah, if there was a wedding, if your teacher, if your community leader picked up the phone or shot you an email or a text and said, I'm thinking of you, you'll remember it forever. And those small things are going to be the things that we take with us, because they're going to keep being the thing that makes us important, those interactive moments. That's why you send your kid to school, because they're going to pass someone in the hallway and someone's going to see them and remember them and pull them in. It's the I see you moment. You're not just a body. Like, you count because I see you. So those gestures, those small gestures, and if you haven't been the one to do them yet, please, on the 184 people, if everybody at the end of this beautiful, amazing day of amazing, elevated learning and communal growth, if everybody here shoots one text to one person that they haven't reached out to yet in the last week and a half, that's 184 people that will remember you forever. So those small things stay. I think that, to me, the biggest piece is the Shabbos table conversation. When we get back to having guests again, what's the Shabbos table conversation going to be? And if you want to have shuls and you want to have day schools, please be careful, moms and dads and aunts and uncles and siblings and everybody, whether you talk about the value of Jewish education in front of the kids who are sitting at the table, do you want them to want to go to school? Do you want them to want to respect their teachers? How are you talking about what their experience is? And if you want to have a Jewish day school, let's be honest. If you lost your job and you can't afford the tuition, that is a legitimate thing. But if you don't really want to pay the tuition, that's a different thing. Let's be honest about what's going on. If you have a kid in preschool and they're not getting very much because you can't do very much online with your younger kid, I understand you're not getting a lot of bang for your buck, but if you expect that their preschool teachers are going to wait around to get paid, that's difficult. Be careful how you speak about Jewish day schools, about their teachers, about their communal people in front of your kids and in front of other people. Because if you want these things to be there for you when COVID is cured, Be'ezrat Hashem, we need to build up and be respectful of them always. Can I say one more thing? I'll say one more thing. Moms and dads and people of all ages, grown-ups experience virtual online communities very differently than younger people do. So if you look over here, many adults have their videos on. Some of us do not. If you are a middle schooler, especially a girl, but not to be limited to, here's what that feels like. You're looking at how you look the whole time, and you're looking on your phone for everyone else who's liked and unliked anything else you've posted in social media, and you're not 100% present. So having the video on for you as a middle schooler and a high schooler is really difficult for many of us. In fact, where adults are thriving with this, for a lot of our teens and our middle schoolers especially, this is really, really, really challenging. So one thing we need to work with our parents on is teaching in our schools, is teaching our kids social emotional skills like conversation. This sounds crazy, but they don't often talk to each other now more than ever. They don't see each other in the hallway. They don't even have each other's phone numbers all the time because they communicate through social media. So it's really important that we reach out and have those one-on-one conversations that parents support. We can't assume our parents have the skills to do that, or we need to teach them how, in the same way that our parents have to support their kids more with the Judaic studies. They may not have the background to help them with that homework. There's a whole lot of things going on here that we can't assume are the same experience for kids as they are for the adults. And obviously there's a lot more to say with that, but I'll end with a point of play is really important. It's how kids grow, it's how adults grow too, but we just don't like to admit it. Playing is really important. So we have to let our kids find ways to play. That's it. I have a lot more to say, but yeah.
Thank you. I imagine that each of you can do this for several hours at a time, and are, you know, so we're trying to just to pull it all together. Yoni, if you can address this issue as well, the realigning of priorities and palpable and direct changes on a community level.
Yeah, sure. My personal bias is that there should be a realignment toward information for the community, which seems to be lacking now that the CJN is gone. But let's put that aside for a minute. I think realistically speaking, the focus in the short term has to be on philanthropy, because that is how the community will need to survive, at least in the short term. I don't think it's a secret for people to see that there is some sort of austerity probably coming for a lot of people. And that will affect, as we've talked about, all community institutions, shuls, schools, and everything in between. And so it kind of, when I look at those things, I think, where does it all end? And it ends in philanthropy. So that is, you know, that will obviously fall in a large part on people who have been generous with their funds before in the Jewish community. But I would imagine that there will also be a push like there have been before in times when either the Jewish community in Canada was not in its best shape or Israel was not in its best shape, where everyday people in the community stepped up and gave whatever they could whenever they could. And there's a great opportunity there to foster unity in the community and to sort of break barriers between, Rabbi Krochman was saying before, the people who make big simchas and the people who either can't make big simchas or feel like they have to make them because everybody else is making them. I'd add one other thing. What will be an interesting shift in priorities will be where Israel falls on that list. I think it's gratifying for all of us to see the news from Israel that the virus seems to be under control there, in large part because of fairly strict measures that were put in place very early on. But Israel is still going to have to deal with the economic fallout the same way every nation is going to, and there will surely be calls for Jewish community dollars outside of Israel and the diaspora to go to Israel. And the question will be, what is that new relationship looking like? You know, Israel has one great resource that they can share with the rest of the diaspora fairly easily is educational. And I could see a situation where Jewish day schools in the diaspora pair up with schools in Israel as a way to save money on, you know, for example, Ivrit lessons. And there are also sorts of other ways that Jewish kids from around the world can interact. There is a great opportunity there to create unity on a scale that we haven't seen on some time. And, you know, and if it sort of ends up being a great new Jewish deal that, you know, brings in Jews from around the world working on common causes, then that would be a great thing. But I do think the relationship and sort of the back and forth and give and take between Israel and the diaspora will have to change in some respects.
Thank you, Yoni. I think in the interest of time and looking at some of the questions, they're quite provocative. And I think I'd like to, with the permission of the panelists, I know we talked about a third question, but I would really prefer to actually go to some of the questions and get your thoughts. Some of them are directed to each one of you as individuals, and maybe we'll just take that cue. Rachel, you spoke about kids loving davening. Can you please elaborate what davening looks like and how it works for kids, students at home in an ideal way?
There's 100 questions in that, but I think that I can share what I've heard about people doing around North America, and it depends on the age. Here's my basic feeling. This is my personal bias. It really depends on the teacher and how much the teacher has a great relationship with the students. If a teacher has a great relationship with his or her students, then usually the tefillah is a beautiful experience and it has ups and downs. If a teacher did not always have a great relationship with his or her students, then tefillah is suffering. For younger kids, when you have the songs and you have a lot of the opportunity to sing together, for many families, and I've heard this across the board, so many parents are learning through their kids. And it's been an incredibly beautiful experience for the parents to experience Judaism through their children and get to dialogue because they're hearing the songs and they're engaging with that. My own children, I've seen them, you know, say Hallel via Zoom. There is certainly something missing without being together, but there's also something really beautiful about having this sort of a privacy about being behind a screen. So I think that, I don't know what the ideal situation would be. It certainly is empowering to think that even if a kid were sick at home, God forbid, and couldn't come to school, that we would have the mechanism through which that the kid could still participate in some way in tefillah. I think there's a lot we can learn about how tefillah can be improved, in fact, about how all of our Judaic studies can be improved. I saw someone post something about grading. There's a lot to say about that. And how, again, getting clear on our why and what is it that we're having our students do together that's value added and not just something they got from a shiur. Because if it's the sage on the stage and someone's just lecturing, they can get that on YouTube for free.
Thank you, Rachel. Rabbi Karapkin, there's some concern that many of the social Jews may decide to opt out altogether. This could manifest both in shul attendance and in day school choices. How do we keep these members of the community committed to the institutions? This has huge repercussions on the next generation's choices regarding buying into Orthodox Judaism.
It's a great question. And I don't think first of all, I think that it's predicated on a fear that may not be founded in reality. I'm not sure. As I mentioned, I think the people who have mishul the most are the people who are the socially Orthodox, because they in many ways get the most out of coming to shul. So I think that there's going to be a clamoring to return to those social structures, and I'm not convinced that people who are socially Orthodox are going to use this opportunity to check out. But I would like to say something, if I can wax philosophical. Every generation exfoliates religiously. And if this is an exercise in exfoliation, then that's part of some kind of larger divine plan that's not really within our control. The question assumes that there's something that we can do to control the direction of where our social structures are going. What we've seen through this pandemic is that as much as we think we can control things, we really don't in the larger scheme of things. I think that there are many things that we've learned about how to up our game as professionals, as educators, as rabbis, as administrators of organizations. And we're going to have to take that with us. As Yoni mentioned, the economic pressures are mounting. And so it's going to be sink or swim. And we're going to have to learn how to be more competitive than ever and more attractive to our client base than ever before. And hopefully it'll be the economic incentives that will help us to do as much as we can to become even more attractive to people who are looking for something to fill that void in their lives.
Thank you, Rabbi. Yoni, I was wondering if you can comment on the notion post-coronavirus, do you see this as an opportunity for there to be more harmony and less disunity amongst the different factions of Jews, Orthodox, conservative, Reform?
Yeah, I think there's some evidence, and at least in the United States, that this is happening already. The conservative and Reform movements are working together in some ways. I think that has led to some concern in both camps that, maybe they're inching too far together. But, I suppose everybody sort of needs to try and work together wherever they can at the moment. I think in general, there is a great argument to be made for more communal unity now. We're all going through basically the same thing in the same way. And we probably never had more similar lives than we do right now. So the case for unity is fairly obvious. That being said, I wouldn't say that I'm confident that's what will eventually happen. It's equally possible that various fractions of the community, whether that's based on denomination or observance or politics or your views about Israel, I think it's equally possible that those little communities that are finding ways to communicate even now will only be strengthened. And that might come that might affect how truly unified we all can be. I think, you need to make, on a communal level, you need to make a concerted effort to make unity important if you think it is important. You need to put it right at the top of that priority list we were talking about before. I don't know that everybody does think that is the most important, but it seems obvious to me at this point that there's never been a better opportunity or a better starting base from which to pursue that goal.
Thank you, Yoni. There's an intriguing question here, Rachel. Can we envision schools where there would be no marks for Torah subjects?
Yeah, for sure, you can. The truth is, it's fascinating, right? I think every school has currency, right? So every school shows that they value something. There's different ways to do it. Some schools show currency by giving time, How many hours in the day do we give to the subject? Sometimes schools and communities give currency to a subject by giving a grade. There's only chashivas, there's only importance if you're graded. If you're not graded, then the school doesn't see it as important. And it's a cyclical thing, right? Because it's the way the parents look. It's a chicken and egg situation, right? If all the parents decide, well, we're only going to pay attention to the subjects where you get a grade, then they're sending the message that Judaic studies isn't important. And it's really challenging. How do you decide where import is? How do we decide where we put our attention and where we give respect? And I would switch it on us. I think that we can stop giving grades in Judaic studies, which is possible, at the same time as it would be the best thing for all of our kids to say, Mom and Dad, I really want to go into being a teacher for Judaic studies. Like, can you imagine if all of our kids said, like, the ultimate job was to be a teacher? And you don't have to worry about grades anymore. I'm being facetious. But how amazing would that be if all the kids said, like, the ultimate, the highest job, the best job I dreamt of, maybe I'll qualify to be a Judaic studies teacher. Then the chashivas is there. So it's a question about what does it mean to have a grade and what does it mean to be evaluated? That's a different question. But it's not so simple. So the answer is, yeah, there could be a situation where there aren't grades for sure. There might be a situation where there aren't grades for any subjects. I think that's totally a worthy subject, you know, discussion to have. And what does it mean to be evaluated in any case? Am I evaluating your skills, your ability to comprehend, to apply it to your life? What does the grade really show? It's definitely worth a conversation, but I don't think it should be just Judaic studies. And I certainly think it goes hand in hand with how the whole community looks at the whole realm of Jewish education in general.
Thank you, Rachel. Rabbi Karopkin, this question has two parts. The first part is in the phase before a vaccine is available, and then the second part would be post-vaccine. So a member of the shul approaches you and says, Rabbi, I actually have no interest in returning to the parking lot to put on tefillin and daven 20 minutes at home, and as per the RCA guidelines for in the short term, I think my davening is of a higher quality at home. How would you, what kind of advice would you have to that individual? And then part B is fast forward. We're all back to shul. It's all back to the old way. And someone has the same notion and says, my davening is actually a lot better in my home. What do you say to both of those individuals in different times?
Thanks, Reb Laser. Before I answer your question, I just want to go back to the issue of community unity that Yoni was dealing with. There's certainly a lot to be said about how this pandemic has helped us have a greater appreciation for community and kihila and coming back together and rebuilding ourselves as a community once again. There's something else that I think needs to be observed, and I'm just starting to develop the idea, but I think it's an important idea. As much as this has helped my community and myself, together with my other rabbinic colleagues, feel a sense of togetherness and unity in the way that we've been communicating with each other, it's also, unfortunately, and I don't say this with any relish, helped us to define certain divides that were always there, but that we sort of swept under the carpet. There are certain divides, even within an Orthodox community, that we wish wouldn't exist, but certain approaches towards religion became more accentuated as a result of this pandemic. When we shut down our shul, we were the first large shul in Toronto to officially declare that we were closed. And one of our neighboring shuls, which is a little smaller, immediately sent out an email that the rabbi said that he has a havtacha, he has a guarantee from the gedolim that anyone who continues davening at shul will be saved from any kind of illness. And this was sort of the beginning of a certain kind of divide that became manifest within the community as to what the role of religion is in the face of medical knowledge, in the face of what society is going through, etc. And it's a much larger issue. I don't know if this opens a can of worms, but I think that there have been specific divides that have been created attitudinally and religiously in the way that we look at each other and the way that we approach our Yiddishkeit. I know Dr. Pelkovitz was touching on it before. It's not a Haredi modern Orthodox divide necessarily, because there are many in the Haredi community who took the very same pragmatic approach to their religious observance and didn't allow it to overshadow the realities of the medical world around us. But it's something that needs to be thought about and digested a little bit more. To go back to your question, which is a purely of a religious nature, as far as how one expresses themselves religiously within community. So someone says they're not interested in coming back to Minyan. Someone wants to daven bi'chidut, daven privately to themselves. Even before the pandemic started, I don't know if you remember, Reb Lazer, but I gave, I think it was either Shabbos HaGadol or Shabbos Shuva, that I said publicly, before any of us knew that we would have to shut down a shul, any rabbi ever entertained the possibility that they would have to lock the doors of their synagogue. I said publicly, you know, it's not so bad once in a while if you don't come to Minyan, because then you could actually learn to slow down your tefillah and to actually have a meaningful dialogue, or at least speak to God without any distractions, without any ulterior motives, and break the routines. I cannot say in good conscience that I would tell a person, as a general rule, you're mechuyev to come to Minyan. Certainly if you need to say Kaddish, certainly periodically you should be coming to Minyan and davening, because we all know the halacha that the Shekhinah comes down to a Minyan of men davening. Whereas if you daven bi'yichidut, if you pray privately, you are reliant upon the angels to transport your prayers up to heaven instead of the divine presence coming in your midst. All of that we know. We know that on a cerebral level. But on the visceral level of what my prayer actually means and what the whole concept of prayer is, I only speak for myself when I say that prayer is an art that is largely lost on me, unless, except for those few specks of light that we occasionally experience once a week or once a month even. They're very, very rare elevating experiences that can be transformative. And if a person says to me in earnest that I find that I do so much better davening bi'yichidut, davening privately instead of coming to shul, how could I, as a religious leader, possibly tell the person that he's making a mistake? I don't think that I could in good conscience, but I would tell the person that just, you know, don't disappear entirely. If you feel you need to daven at home because you're getting more out of it, then come to shul for shiurim, come to shul for classes. There, the social, as Mrs. Dratch said, the social interaction of a synagogue is still vital, not only for our kids, but for adults as well. And coming to a shir and feeling the energy of a room filled with people learning Torah together cannot be imitated on a Zoom call. So if a person finds his prayer service, his prayer experience better, then they should find some social outlet for coming together with other Jews to do other kinds of mitzvot.
Okay. Rob, I'd like to go back to the it's interesting, we're going back and forth. I'd like to go to continue that conversation you started with regards to the community and the unity. It seems to be a theme and a thread in some of the questions here, and perhaps we can just explore it a little bit. This morning we heard from Rabbi Steinberg in Israel that there was a disproportionate amount of the of mortality and morbidity in the Haredi community. The question, of course, nobody understands why or how, but some of the theories were perhaps the delay in closing shuls and things of that nature. And we're seeing some of this going on at the present time. And so in every community, but I wonder if we could speak to the issues in Toronto as a springboard for that. Where do we need to go with this? I mean, there's the re-entry phase now, and some of the questioners are really cautioning, and there seems to be a divide along this nature, although we may not call it Haredi, non-Haredi, but there seems to be some divide that just doesn't understand it. What would be the responsibility, and how do we go about that?
Well, you know, fortunately, Toronto, the Toronto rabbinate doesn't have too many outliers and rebels and rabble rousers. You know, Canadians are just mellow kinds of people. You know, we're all cool. We're all chilled, you know? So even the most radical of the rabbis are not going to go rogue in that sense, but there are differing attitudes. Look, it's no secret because I'm so involved with the RCA. We know that up until very recently, Agudas Yisrael and the OU and RCA were all on the same page. We've got to take this seriously. We've got to obey all of the secular laws that our politicians have put into place for social distancing and for not gathering for religious purposes. About 2 weeks ago did we see a palpable divide start to materialize between Aguda and the OU. And that difference was a very, very subtle point. And that was, how long do we wait before reopening? So Agudas Yisrael took the position with all of the same precautions in place for reopening, wearing the masks and staying 6 feet apart from each other and doing outdoor minyanim and so forth and so on. But their position is and remains that as soon as the government says that you can reopen, sei gesund, go ahead and knock yourselves out. The attitude of the OU remains that as soon as the government tells you that it's safe to gather for prayer, wait 14 days, because there's an acknowledgement from anyone that you speak to, since we really don't fully, even the medical community doesn't fully understand the nature of this virus. Every allowance of social integration is a social experiment, is really a medical experiment to see what's going to happen. Are the numbers going to go back up? Are things going to continue to stay stable? And if the numbers go up after we reopen, we'll have to close them. That's what we're hearing everybody say. So can you really justify gathering for tefillah b'tzibur, gathering for communal prayer, to be a guinea pig in this medical experiment? The OU's position in consultation with its medical experts is that for essential things that you need in order to be able to continue life, you can justify social interaction. You need groceries, so you go to the grocery store. But if you can get by without going to shul and waiting to see what happens as a result of social reintegration, then you have to wait. You have to take pikuach nefesh as the most overriding, prevailing concern. It goes back to what I started before, Dr. Friedman, which is how literally do we take this attitude of shomer mitzvah lo yeda davara? There's a phrase that he who observes a mitzvah will not experience anything deleterious as a result of his performance of the mitzvah. Somebody tried to use that as an explanation as to why it was safe to reopen our shuls. And I turned to that person incredulously. Are you meshuga? Hasn't the pandemic taught you that just because you're in the process of doing a mitzvah doesn't mean that you're protected from a pandemic? And there's a certain cognitive dissonance that still exists, even as we speak, between people who are devoutly religious and believe that their observant lifestyle does have protective abilities because they have very strong bitachon. I would argue that it's an overly simplistic bitachon, which is why it results in these kinds of theological mistakes of judgment. But nonetheless, it is a bitachon. It is a type of trust in God. But at the same time, I think that's really what we're seeing. We're seeing us sort of diverging in two different directions. Eventually, those differences will disappear again or become less visible as life gets back to normal and we're able to resume business as a community. But to me, it's fascinating. There was an article by Shaul Magid. I don't know how many of you saw it. He's a bit of a rabble rouser. He's the type of guy who, you know, will find the reason to protest anything and to be a contrarian. But he wrote an article about how the modern Orthodox really don't believe what they study in the Torah as much as the Haredi community. I don't agree with that analysis at all. The reason why we were so quick to close our shuls is because we realize that in order to be a fully comprehensive Eved Hashem, a servant of God, you have to synthesize the Torah with the realities of the world around you. We don't live in a fantasy world. We live in the real world, and therefore we have to take what the real world presents to us and then synthesize it with what the Torah tells us. Oh, so much more to discuss, but I don't want to...
Thank you, Rabbi. Well, in the time that we have remaining, I was going to ask that if each of the participants can give a one-minute soundbite to close their program. And Yoni, we'll ask you to go ahead first. One-minute soundbite.
I think it behooves everybody in the Jewish community to do what Rabbi Karapin was just talking about, sort of trying to figure out the balance between our spiritual and our religious experiences, and on one hand, and on the other hand, what the medical community is telling us. And, you know, that could be frustrating because that information seems to change from day to day as we learn more and we figure out what works and what doesn't work. So in the short term, I think really the game is a game of patience and planning for when we can be together and think about what our community is going to look like. This will not go on forever. We'll figure out how to be together again, whether that's because of a vaccine or some other reason. We are a genius enough people to figure out our place in a changing world that has never changed. And I have every expectation that there will be great Jewish ideas about what comes out of this. And the important thing for the community is to listen to as many of those ideas, gather them up, weigh them against each other. And then as definitively as we can, chart a path forward.
Thank you, Yoni. Rachel?
I want to echo, I guess, Dr. Pelkovitz in gratitude and say thank you to everybody who's here. Thank you for including me, and thank you to the amazing teachers and the leaders in our communities who are giving 24/7. Thank you to the people who are being brave and staying home. You know, remembering that Hashem had to tell us not once and not twice, but more, not to touch Har Sinai, because there's such a draw to go back, to be together and to be close to Hashem. And that all of this desire to come back is really from such a good place, but that if Hashem has to tell us, guys, don't touch Har Sinai so many times, don't touch Har Sinai. But really, thank you to everybody. And I hope that we, when we're supporting one another through this time, we can remember that we're all fragile and everyone here is carrying their desire to touch Har Sinai. And maybe with a little bit of sympathy and empathy and understanding, it'll help.
Thank you, Rachel. Rabbi, final comment.
I miss my family in California. I miss the ability to get on a plane to fly to Eretz Yisrael. And I think that all of us miss that freedom to be able to get out and spread our wings. But I truly am grateful, just to echo the gratitude line, the gratitude theme. I am grateful that if I have to be in Galut, I'm in such an amazing community in Thornhill with the Bayit community, with so many of these people that are on the call tonight. And I just, after everything's said and done, I really do look forward to joining back together with you and thinking about what that first Shabbos is going to be like when we're all back in shul together. Hopefully it'll be very soon. And then we'll all start thinking about Aliyah plans at that point. But thank you all for joining.
Wonderful. So on behalf of Torah in Motion, I would really like to close our session and our full conference today. It's been amazing. And I want to thank all of our speakers tonight, Rachel Dratch, Yoni Goldstein, and Rabbi Karapkin in particular for this evening. If I may, I just want to just conclude with one final thought. It's really an outgrowth of what Rabbi Steinberg spoke about today. And his last slide, it reminded me of Rav Soloveitchik's teaching. Our business in this world is not to sort of understand the word lama, to try to figure out why. Our goal is to understand lama, to what. And that is what Rabbi Steinberg was alluding to today. And throughout the entire day, that is one of the themes that has been there very succinctly. Where are we going to go? What are we going to do? And will we change as a culture, as a people? And so much has been learned. And thank you to all the participants. Thank you to Rabbi Kelman and Torah Moshe, Ilana working in the background. For those of you that are interested in the CME, it's posted here on the side. You'll just have to just go onto the website. There is a lead a link to follow. And if you have any questions, email us any of them. We hope to see you in person, God willing, next year. Although I did see a comment that there is an opportunity to Zoom. So Rabbi Jay will have to do some homework on that.
I want to thank, Laser really for all his hard work and a pleasure working with him. Thank you. It has been such an inspiring day, such a wonderful day. We knew we planned a nice program, but it's hard. How's it going to go on Zoom, something like this? We had hundreds of people throughout the day, never less than 150 people. And I think it's amazing. And I know by the quality of the crowd, and I you can feel the warmth of a community. And really, I want to thank you and some of the insightful comments. And there's a lot to think about. And we look forward to learning with you. Tomorrow morning, 11 a.m., Menachem Liebtag, Mamad Har Sinai, Parshat V'chanan. 8:30, Dr. Mark Shapiro on his letters to Gedolim. Continuing all through the week, Tuesday morning, Rabbi Doron Perez, the head of Mizrahi. Wednesday morning, Benny Gesundheit. Thursday morning, I'll be speaking. We keep online all the shiurim every day. So much learning, and it's so much. There is the unity, the community coming together. And we look forward that after, when we can go back to shul, we can go back to shul and Zoom. Take the good aspects of Zoom and the good aspects of shul. And Rabbi Karapkin, I wish you 100% hatzlacha to get rid of the kiddush clubs. And I'm with you 100%. I'm with you about a lot you said, but I thank you for the courage for saying what has to be said, because that's a very important point. And I want to wish everybody well, be healthy, be well. We'd like to hear from you, any comments or suggestions for other programs. And thank you for being with all day and for giving us the opportunity to create such an inspiring day. Laila Tov to everyone.